Well,
Sure.
Meredith, congratulations on your exciting new pamphlet from Haitian Press, Transpiration, which is a great title. I wondered if I might begin by talking a little bit about the blurb, actually. I don't always start by talking about the blurb. This is like a very obvious place to start. But in terms of the summary of the pamphlet, just so people know what's going on, it says that Transpiration contains poems that consider the possibilities for intimacy with the natural world around us and with each other. So I wondered. This is quite a big question to start off with, but given the state of the environment, maybe the state of the world politically as well, do you think that those kind of possibilities for intimacy are still open to us?
Yes, I think they're always open to us. It's just in perhaps, increasingly changing ways. Like some of the thinking I was going through, like in writing a lot of the pieces in this pamphlet, Donna Haraway has like the concept of kin making. And part of that is like a turning toward kind of animal life or plant life or whatever. But in so doing, also, like leaving space for the expectation that that life would turn away from you also, like in your turning toward it. And, I think that's just related to the process of intimacy in general with anything amongst humans or human to plant life, human to animal life. So the possibility is always there. It's just it may take different shapes or forms than you expect, and you kind of have to be ready for your expectations to be disrupted through that, I guess.
Yeah, that's really interesting, actually, because it's the idea of being disrupted can sometimes, for some people, I suppose, be an uncomfortable sensation that, those kind of relationships you thought existed between you and other people, or you and the world around the animal or world around you, for example, are somehow not what you expected. So I was kind of interested in that idea throughout the pamphlet that you are kind of talking about there, about the sense in which that relationship with the world and our relationships with each other can somehow be paralleled. We can kind of think about them in similar ways, and there are, I guess there were quite a few poems in the pamphlet that do that.
This is just fresh on my mind, but obviously I've been deep in the reality TV trenches after, being deep in the editing trenches. I really had to loosen my brain. But it's in all the dating shows, it's like the source of so much strife is just people having these expectations for their partners and then, being so angry that people can't meet these made up expectations despite, having the person right in front of them demonstrating that they're incapable of meeting those expectations.
Do you feel like you have, I don't know, that your expectations of the natural world are very different to your expectations of people? Do you feel more, I don't know, do you feel more generously inclined towards the natural world than you do to people? Because of course, a lot of that discussion, and particularly you're talking about, Haraway's ideas of sort of kinship and things, we need to feel closer perhaps to the natural world nowadays because so much of it has been lost or so much of it has been damaged, and we need to recognize responsibility for that.
Yeah, I mean, I think maybe originally, or maybe like just kind of like more societally, we grow up with this expectation or like this romanticization of the natural world, right? And you kind of project this expectation onto it. And because it's like unspeaking beings who communicate outside of languages we're familiar with, it's easier to assume that they're meeting you with like warmth or something. I remember I was like reading, or C.A. Conrad, poet, was talking about, and they were saying something about you can try to like reach out to a tree and exist with a tree or whatever, but they're like, trees fucking hate us.
It's a really interesting point you make about Conrad, because that kind of suggests, that the animals, the plants, they don't owe us anything. So that idea that we could somehow set up a relationship with them, if they don't want that relationship, then what situation does that place us in? I mean, that obviously it gets to that whole point about anthropocentrism and the extent to which so much of our history has been around centering the human being, whereas in fact we should be thinking about, as Haraway does, completely the opposite in a way, or at least finding more of an equal plane, I suppose, to talk about kind of animals, plants, human beings, and non-human life. What you're talking about there reminds me very much of that residency that you had in Finland, where you were very much engaged with those kind of questions and questions around trees, and spaces that you were kind of inhabiting every day. without people, largely, I think. Could you
Yeah.
talk a little bit about that, and then that will get us to read one of the poems from the pamphlet.
Yeah, so earlier this year in February, I went on a residency up in central Finland with the Mustarinda Association. It's kind of an eco-retreat type thing. It's very co-op oriented. You go stay there, everyone kind of works together to keep the place clean and running. And they've just done a really good job building a space that's just very oriented toward, the type of kind of thinking around the environment and other places. So I spent a month up there, and this was in, the middle of February. It's kind of deep winter. And I think I went up there expecting, oh, there will be all this wildlife that I'm not familiar with and what have you, and all these different plant lives. But this is, under 2 meters of snow, and it's the time of year where all the animals are in kind of hibernation, and there's really not a lot of like movement in the forest. Everything's frozen. It's eerily quiet. You go maybe 100 meters out into the forest and you can't hear anything. The house falls away. You probably don't run into other people. But there's still like these signs of life having existed in the same place as you. Sometimes that's just through like animal tracks in the snow, which is mostly just like hares or rabbits at that time of year. You kind of see the ski cuts or snowshoe footprints of other people from the house. So that was like just kind of the parameters of that situation to then really immerse in trying to relate to plant life or, more than human life. Just for me, that was of course going to be the trees because that's kind of the only thing out there at that point. But I've always been fascinated with trees because they kind of exemplify that like deep time thing, right? Or they exist so much longer than our lifespans. And therefore the kind of there's like this embodied knowledge or history that goes beyond your understanding of your lifetime.
Yeah, that was a beautiful description of what it was like there. Thank you very much. And that kind of description comes across again in several of the poems in the pamphlet, actually, that we have this kind of whole sort of sequence of poems which are responses to that residency. So I wonder if you could read one of those, which is called Ecotone, which I think will echo some of the things you've just been saying. And then maybe we can talk about that one and that idea of the kind of human and non-human.
I molt my way toward wherever the leftover energy goes, the path seasoned since last snowfall by the footsteps and ski cuts of hundreds. In another swampland, a family takes loop after loop through their forest. A grandfather is born in a sauna like so many others before. My grandfather had his name tattooed on his knuckles. To the family, a source of great shame, but I admire the recognition of the self in language, the clarity he found in his naming, essential as rhyme. In the forest, a tree creaks in the wind, made louder by the pillar of ice clung firmly to its side, bonded via a nightly freezing of fog drifting spectral through the wood. As the wind convulses its shoulders, a friction of bark and ice tap out vegetal code words. Pay attention. I'm here, I say. I hear you. Letters form in the snow. I trace them with my breath. The swamp will thaw in season, the gray birdhouse increasingly embellished with green. I lay one hand on a lifeless tree, feel the pulse of it emerge from the cold. My skin sticks to the bark and peels off painfully. Must it have such grief as to hold back my flesh? In her base, I find a nail. planted by human hammer with human hand.
Seems to me that this one really does get at all those things you were just talking about in terms of what is it like to encounter a tree, obviously in that environment, but that also that sense of the house you were describing kind of has falling away, you know, just kind of disappearing, and a kind of tuning in to treeness or something, or kind of trying to get as close as you possibly can. What is it particularly here in this poem about the tree that's so important? You have this kind of sense of trying to sort of almost like restart a relationship with the tree, I suppose. I think of all those terrible things we've done, and that kind of reference to the human hammer with the human hand at the end of the poem, the nail being embedded in it.
Yeah, totally. And that was like very much part of kind of my process on this residency. I kind of, once I settled into things, I was attempting to establish kind of a daily ritual, not only around like my writing practice, but also around, trying to reset the way in which I interact with the natural world. And I was also thinking about, like how to center or how to decenter kind of human language in these relations, which is challenging as a poet, and I'm not bilingual or multilingual or anything. It's like I only have English and the limits of that, and I feel like I'm constantly very conscious of the limits of just being someone who only speaks or thinks or reads in one language, right? Because kind of the way we think through language affects the way you perceive the world and the limits of your consciousness around that. Yeah, so thinking about like writing, how to write in a way that invited like kind of the voice of the natural world in when it's an unspeaking being in the way I understand speech. That was challenging. It's like kind of the initial impulse is like, okay, if I remove the lyric I, it's like but that felt too obvious or not quite right. And also the I kind of felt important in thinking about, this kind of concept of deep time outside of the human, incorporating kind of your ancestral lineage and relationships with that. But part of my ritual on this residency was kind of every day heading out into the forest and trying to listen and notice things about the forest that felt kind of outside of my regular time and ways I interact with things. So I would go and just kind of walk out until there was like a tree that kind of like called to me, and then I would go sit with it for an hour, and I would pull my notebook out in the freezing cold and make notes. And I was trying to make notes about, using the senses beyond sight, which kind of also tends to take over kind of perception, I think, often. So a lot of that was, listening and smell and feeling, trying to kind of like sense through the skin. But a lot of like through a lot of these kind of interactions with specific trees, there would be these situations of like inadvertent violence, human violence toward the tree, or well, I mentioned that here, right, where I was sitting with this tree and then I notice a nail in the base, and that just feels emblematic. But there was another instance, and I kind of loosely make reference to this in another poem in the pamphlet, The Forest in Winter. But I was, sitting with this tree, and then I kind of finished my ritual of interacting with it and writing into it and writing around it, and I stand up to leave, and I completely lose my balance on the skis, and I fall, and just intuitively reach for kind of whatever I can to not completely fall. And what that ends up being is just this tiny little branch on the edge of the tree. And, obviously that immediately snaps off. And I just, that felt so emblematic for just kind of the human effort toward addressing climate change or addressing a relationship with the natural world, is that it's like no matter how kind of noble or generous the intention, in kind of your flail for survival, humans will always harm as kind of a secondary thing. And I think that's true interpersonally as well, right?
one of the ways which you do that, certainly in the Ecotone poem, is to think about it in terms of human relationships as well, which is something that people might find easier to relate to. So those references, as you were mentioning earlier, about generations, the references to the grandfather in here, the grandfather who might be the one in Finland, born in the sauna, like so many others before, but also then references to my grandfather, you say, and that idea of the grandfather having his name tattooed on his knuckles. That was really interesting because it starts to get at those questions again, which you briefly mentioned earlier about language and what kind of language is adequate to talk about this kind of experience, and is there a language that we can use? There's a reference here to where the speaker says that you admire the recognition of the self in language, writing on the knuckles of the name, and it seems that in this poem, maybe other poems as well, actually, you have this kind of almost hyper awareness of language. The way in which naming can be very powerful. There's quite a lot of wordplay. There's some here where you have rhyme, RIME, as the kind of the frost, isn't it? And RHYME, or the here and here, HERE and HEAR. I'm here, I hear you, thinking about the tree. So I was interested to know whether you think language, even if you feel, some of you only have one language to use. Can that be really important, though, in drawing attention to human failures, but also advocate for connection with the natural world?
It's that poetic sensibility of the defamiliarizing through manipulation of language. If you kind of think into the richness and multiple meanings and etymology of words and all this, all those different meanings or kind of subverted meanings open up, and it just shakes up your way of thinking about things. It's like I have the limits of one language, but within that language, right, there's still ways to destabilize kind of your way of thinking. The lines you point out with the kind of the grandfathers, those felt like really potent details to me for multiple reasons. When I was in Finland, the sauna culture is huge there. So, at this residency, we're doing these weekly or biweekly saunas, and chatting with kind of Finnish artists who are there. The sauna is like this, it's just a very like sacred conception of the sauna, right? As this kind of almost like hearth of families, but beyond a single generation. Like it was, people were referencing it's very common for. They knew grandparents or their partner's grandparents were born in saunas, and often saunas would be like where the body would be placed after death for a few days or something. So it's kind of this really sacred site of life and death, and this like embodied being, but also the absence of a being in the body or something. And I think I also was thinking about that in relation to like spirituality. Which again is also, kind of a big theme or query within the pamphlet. I have this very Catholic kind of Puritan background. It's kind of the Christian notion of what like nakedness as shame and are very connected to shame. Being in the sauna where nudity is sacred and there's this whole kind of circle of life and history and ancestral history happening in that space. That's just a very simple way of destabilizing, a lot of kind of influential life conceptions that you're kind of born into and absorb through just kind of the worlds in which you grow up. So kind of that's one angle. And then with the other line about my grandfather and the tattoo on his knuckles, that's a potent detail, especially just in my family, just because my grandfather, he had his name tattooed on his knuckles, but which we always found interesting because he ended up dying of Alzheimer's eventually. So there's kind of this the name on his knuckles took on this new meaning as he kind of like lost his understanding of who he was and what the world was. But there was still this kind of orienting like this is who you are. This name. And yeah, I think I'm constantly interested in the concept of just naming in general because names, it's a kind of permanence thing. When you're long gone, your name may kind of anchor things you did or memories related to you, you know? So there's kind of something more permanent in naming.
Yeah, what is in that thing that Emerson says in that the poet essay where he talks about how part of the poet's role is to be the namer of things. So that sense in which, I mean, that's in, you may or may not agree with kind of Emerson's very traditional male-dominated sense of what the poet should be. But that idea that the poet has a kind of gift, I suppose, and the kind of the seer idea as well is part maybe part of that, and that kind of sense in which you can see or speak things that other people couldn't necessarily say or see, which I think is interesting. I mean, given again what you're talking about here in terms of trying to cultivate relationships that other people may have disregarded or have been lost over time, particularly with non-human beings around us. But yeah, I mean, all those things that you were talking about in terms of the sauna, and sometimes I think in other cultures as well, there's a sense of it's being a ritual of purification, as well, isn't it? Kind of cleansing the body, and maybe that ties in with that question of kind of spirituality as well. But the embodiment, which is something that people sometimes do feel kind of shame over what their role of their body is, that relates very much to, I think, other things in the pamphlet. There's a your poem, Subliminal, where you talk about presence and absence. At one point, you talk about how absence is impossible. There is only lessened presence, which was really fascinating because on the one hand, there is this sort of tension in the pamphlet between, on the one hand, being very present, as clearly you were attempting to be with the tree, with the trees, and also being quite absent from some places. There's a lot of travel in the pamphlet. There were all kinds of places, actually, not just Finland, but Spain in there. There's obviously the US. References to places like Virginia, states like Virginia, and also Scotland gets in there. Sort of, it's not very explicit, but it's kind of there, just where you are now. So, how do you think about presence in the book, and particularly bodily presence, I suppose, maybe beyond, not just the idea of the sauna, but how the body or that kind of sense of presence appears elsewhere?
I'm very obsessed with understandings of place. And again, like that, yeah, like that destabilization of your conception of space when you kind of divorce it from, an earthly relationship to time. I am not a person who grew up in one place. I was moving all over as a kid, and that's continued as an adult. My orientation of place often feels very unfixed, and feeling like a relationship to being like from somewhere and very secure and kind of maybe like a linear history through an existence in a specific place. In the context of that poem, Subliminal, that very much came out of thinking about the day my grandmother died. I just kind of took off and just drove up into the mountains in northern Arizona, where I was living at the time. And there's something about, and I think Haney maybe gets into this at some point one of his many, but driving as this very like spatio-temporal thing, and I think that's like really palpable when you're driving into a mountainscape in a place like Arizona, where it's like the sedimentary layers are like really visible, and kind of all these histories trace through rock formations and canyons and time through that, and feeling like driving into that as you kind of work through memory related to a person who quite suddenly is no longer here, but is still very like kind of palpably felt, right? Just that sort of parallel.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. And that's also a really interesting example of where the landscape, very particular type of landscape, is allowing you to think through some of those difficulties that you're having after somebody has died, those kind of challenges and that kind of grief. Which again, leads us back to that kind of question of, what do we get from the environment? What do we give to it? What does it give to us? But that seems like, a very say kind of, I don't know, benign relationship. It's not like you're doing any damage to the environment, but you're kind of meeting it, and it is kind of helping you, whether it wants to or not, think through some of those issues of grief. So there's
I mean,
something.
but I am, I'm driving, I'm burning fossil fuel, it's like there's already, I'm on a road, which is already kind of this imposed violence on the earth, so I disagree with saying there's no harm there.
Well, I was trying to be generous, but you're right. I mean, well, that isn't that part of the that's part of the thing, isn't it? It's that question about, well, how do we avoid doing less damage? Maybe it's impossible actually at this stage to completely, reset ourselves. But that's also one of the fascinating things about the pamphlet. One of the things you do so brilliantly is there's this overall tone, I suppose, or kind of sense of resetting. Or there's a poem called Afterlife. Or there's another one which is a, there's literally one of the early poems about Barcelona is going for a hard reset, the poem says. So there's a lot of kind of attempts to sort of begin again or think about what it might be like after something had happened. So that there's this constant kind of strain of danger, really, I suppose, apocalypse ideas about, how do we think about what comes after us? Where would our place be? And yet it's never entirely explicit. That's one of the great things I think about it. It's always kind of humming along in the background. And maybe that speaks to the kind of general tone of the pamphlet. I was thinking about Susanna Dickey, who kindly provided us with an endorsement for the pamphlet. And she says that it strikes a compelling balance between linguistic ambition and wry anecdote. So again, what kind of tone is appropriate for dealing with the really quite challenging ideas that you've got in here about, yeah, certainly about grief that you've just been talking about, but also about environmental damage and whether we've gone too far and whether we can ever, get some of that kind of identity or relationship back with the environment. So how would you think about the tone of the pamphlet? There might be some other poems that you might want to mention, which maybe do slightly different things to what I've just been describing.
Sure. Yeah. Susanna's comments on the pamphlet were so generous, and I'm profoundly grateful to be read like that, especially by a poet and writer I admire. But yes, I think like managing the tone in this pamphlet, but also just in all of my writing, is kind of a constant challenge because I am, I do think I'm thinking and kind of trying to write quite sincerely toward ideas that I find, very, very meaningful. But I do tend to have, kind of like an anxious and dark sense of humor, about everything. So that tends to just seep into my writing just by nature of how I exist, and how I present myself. So I think like in editing, it's, maybe the impulse is to edit those kind of more wry voices out because it doesn't, necessarily appropriately respond to the gravity of the situation or whatever. But it feels like that the kind of wryness feels like a more like human response, I guess. Like, and again, I think that plays just to kind of like the infallibility and just limits of humanness that we'll constantly run up against. And yeah, it's like leaving space for that acknowledges those limits in some way. Rinse Cycle maybe is one of the kind of cheekier poems where there's an aside in the middle. It's more meant for the audience actually, or for the reader. And I like that turn. My mom's always like, "Oh, that's one of your more colorful poems, Meredith." And I'm like, but I think like the kind of the cursing and the cheekiness is important too.
You might have to just read a couple of those lines
Yeah, I was like, do I need to say it?
you've teased people enough with this, certainly your reference to your mother there.
I know. All right. This is Rinse Cycle. We are at the end of everything. The cat bats a cork across the hall and into the bath, interrupting you naked in this domestic enterprise. I too wish to shatter the illusion. Resist the obligation to submit surveys. adding my data to a pile from which we dispense knowledge to nothing. We are more sexually attracted to the trees. Not saying I'd fuck a tree, but the arousal when touching bark is higher than when we consider the possibility of opening up our relationship. There's not just one unknown soldier, but the tombs would have you think otherwise. My hand placed on your unconscious back, erecting, then retreating with sleep breath. What is alive? This felt coexistence. The waterlogged ghost in my wine. There's no such thing as extinction. Someone always inherits the apocalypse exposed in their
Just hope your mother doesn't listen to cool. I'll have to put like a you know when they do, they have to put a little explicit, like a little
Yeah,
E
exactly.
label on this recording.
Please hide your children before listening to
Right before getting, or you could skip the middle of the poem and then it's
me.
okay.
Yeah, there you
But
go.
that poem encapsulates so brilliantly, I think, that sense of that idea of what is it like to be at the end of everything. I mean, whether with tongue in cheek or not. And that's so fantastic about a lot of the poems in here. It's sort of disarmingly clever, those where it sort of disarms us maybe a little bit with the humor or with the tone, and then actually says, yeah, but if we think about this seriously, look at the state we're in and let's try and get to grips with it if we can in language, which is what so much of the pamphlet does.
Yeah, and I wonder again, like using tone to kind of destabilize there and placing that like right before kind of a more serious thinking about something and phrasing around it. It's, you know, there's kind of an encouragement there to, yeah, push through the discomfort of being destabilized or push through the kind of limitations and continue to think deeply into, yeah, I guess the possibilities or whatever there.
Absolutely, and I think again that's what happens a lot of the times in the pamphlet. And overall, I think people, when they've read the whole thing, they might feel a bit shaken up, but that's not necessarily a bad thing. And I'm sure they'll embrace that experience of not feeling entirely comfortable, because the way that we live now is not, so many people, something that we should feel comfortable about. Well, thank you,
Yeah.
Meredith, very much for talking about it, and congratulations again. Really looking forward to. I'm hearing you read some of these at the upcoming launches.
Thank you.